Good evening, everyone. It's 7 o'clock. It's Wednesday night, and we're studying the work, one of the works of E.J. Gold called The Hidden Work. And The Hidden Work was written some time ago, compiled and edited and placed before us. And what we've been doing for the last several months is working our way through the book chapter by chapter. And we've made it to chapter 12. And it has taken, this is our fifth week in studying chapter 12. And part of the reason is that the name of the chapter is Octaves. And part of the reason is it's kind of a new way of thinking for us and the way we've been working for the last couple of years, actually, and the stuff that we've been studying.
Mm-hmm.
Nevertheless, it's a critical piece of information. And so we've taken a lot of time working our way through it. And it's the sort of thing we can come back to again. It's the sort of thing that we can come back to over and over again and see if it's, and get more and more depth out of it. But as I say, it's taken us weeks to get to this point. And that's a good thing. That's a good thing. So this is our fifth go at it. And joining me tonight is M.A., who's Steady Eddie here. And that's always so nice. One of the things I want to emphasize is this is a building block. All of this study is a building block where you get a little bit and a little bit and a little bit. And I sent an email out announcing the class, and one of the points I made in the email was, maybe we don't understand what an octave is, but we hear from Harry, from George, and from others about how it operates. And then we go about our business, we file that away in a sense, but then when we go and we practice it, a little bit of it comes back. And in the practice of prayer absolute, we start to learn a little bit about prayer absolute, but we also start to learn about how that octave works. And we begin to sense its universality. And that's part of what we're doing here. This is a book about the prayer absolute. Turn to the first chapter, M.A., if you would.
The very first chapter?
Very first chapter.
Okay.
And read the header on that first chapter.
That one?
Yeah.
The title of this chapter is A Fragment on Parchment. Even if we knew what human life on earth was for, would knowing the real purpose of our lives be enough of a motivation to actually get to work?
And then as the very, very short first chapter continues, it points to something. It points to maybe a methodology, or it points to something on this fragment.
Mm-hmm.
And what the author is telling us, it says, what if this is all you knew? What if all you knew was the fact of the existence of something called prayer absolute? You didn't know much about it. You didn't know what it meant. You don't know if it was a song. You just knew that it was something written down. It's all you had. Turn to the end of chapter 11. Well, turn to the end of chapter 11 real quick.
Okay.
What page is that?
That is 114.
Go to page 113. All right, so now, let's all work for just a quick second, and you know what I mean when I say this, and let's arrive at the class, okay? Let's arrive at this moment. Let's get ourselves here. There you go. Notice that shift in energy too. Notice the shift in energy. That's part of what the gift is of this prayer, is it's kind of a roadmap to say, to notice that shift in energy. This is not an intellectual exercise. It's something different. So hang on just a moment, and let's read what's there, okay?
Okay.
I'll go ahead. I'll read it. So are you ready?
Are we reading together?
No.
Okay.
In motion, bowing, my presence comes to thee. Humbly, with heart alive, my presence awakens to thee. With clear mind, my presence comes to know thee. With pity for thy suffering, my presence becomes aware of thee. With yearning, my presence wishes to comfort thee. In ignorance, my presence serves thee. In contemplation, my presence recognizes how to serve thee. In mystery, my presence is a comfort to thee. In form and formlessness, my presence becomes thee. So let's say all we had, we're on this desert island, and that's all you have. The author of this manuscript that we're reading and working our way through for all these weeks implies that may be all you need. All you need for what? Now going back to page 128 at the top, prayer absolute is in the form of an objective nine-stepped octave, which includes the two intentional retardations introduced by the internal activities, which is to say, listen now, to say the radiations of non-negative force of an awakened biological machine. Let's just stop on that for a moment. You want to reread that paragraph, M.A.?
This one right here?
Yeah, when I just read it.
Prayer absolute is in the form of an objective nine-step octave, which includes the two intentional retardations introduced by the internal activities, which is to say, the radiations of non-negative force of an awakened biological machine.
It's a curious thing. The interplay between the human biological machine, or to use what's become my favorite term for it that Silverdale gave us many, many, many weeks and weeks and months ago, is the historical personality. The interplay between that and then the essential self. And what that interplay is so dramatic. It's so dramatic that I want to pay careful attention to that, because I know that a number of individuals seem to be having depression from time to time, or they struggle with certain things. It's part of the process. If you start to surrender to what's indicated in that very paragraph on the matrix called the prayer absolute, you'll start to understand that you're being pulled into a new era. You're being pulled into the next phase for yourself. And what does the human biological machine, the historical personality, do? It stomps its feet. It doesn't want that.
I was going to say recoils.
It recoils. It recoils from that because it's a different world. I met with somebody today, a business owner, and they made a critical business decision and were terrified by the decision they made. However, the decision was based on the electrical signature that this person had, was convinced was the right direction to go. But the external, she passed up. In other words, there was a important business opportunity she could have taken, but was convinced that it was the wrong energetic direction. Think about that for a minute. Think about that. She actually made a decision not to go in a certain direction and was terrified by that. What was terrified? It was her habits of looking to the external to guide, right? It's so easy to do that. We look to the external as our only guide because that's all we know. I mean, as George has told us, that's what we're trained at. So we have to have compassion for our biological machine as well and this historical personality. It got us this far.
Was she saying that the energetics weren't there? Is that what you were trying to...
It was wrong.
Yeah, that's what she was feeling.
She could have definitely gone a particular direction. It would have been a definite business coup for her and her business.
Mm-hmm.
But she didn't go that route because the fundamental direction of her business had a different energetic to it, a different mood.
Yeah.
And she would have compromised that if she had gone this other direction. So she was terrified, part of the reason for the meeting, what do I do, what do I do? And then as I started to dig, I realized that other opportunities have already started to come forward.
Mm.
Other business opportunities that have a different nature altogether. So in a certain way, she was rewarded with the risk-taking that she had done.
Mm.
And I want to point out, I don't know if Aria or Jim H. or Talk Lady are on. These are individuals that took a chance, and they came, they in a sense, threw themselves before the group. Is Pianjo on? Susan, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Hi, Susan.
Hi,
good evening. I was wondering if Pianjo would like to, if you're in a position to call in, because I want to read something that he posted yesterday on the site of wingsofchaos.com. And it's going to exemplify this idea. It's the idea of taking a chance. We can't, what's the term that Gurdjieff used, between two stools or something like that? Standing between two stools.
Mm-hmm. Or sitting.
Sitting between two stools,
mm-hmm.
however it works.
Mm-hmm.
We can't do that. We can't hang out there. So we go back to what we know.
Mm-hmm.
Here we are, we're no spring chickens anymore. Some of you might be, but I know I'm not. And it's time to take that leap because you have to actually leave that other stool and leap to something new. If you remain holding on to the old, you can't get to the new. So some of these individuals have done that, even though they just, on the surface, shared a very simple thing.
I think it's without remorse, either.
And without remorse, you just go.
Yeah.
And that's actually a very good point, because that's what we worked on today with this individual,
mm-hmm.
is you're done.
Mm-hmm.
You're done. You took this choice. Go for it.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know,
if you don't do that, then you do keep getting called back to that other stool. You know, you have to make that clean break if you're gonna actually sit on one of those stools
on something new.
Yeah.
And to become, as to quote Maurice Nicole, to become, to enter into the new man,
mm-hmm.
and to become new.
Mm-hmm.
so I'm going to go ahead and read this. I don't know if Tianjo has the ability to get on or not.
David, I'm online here with you.
Okay, I'm going to go ahead and read some of what you posted. Is that okay?
Of course.
It has been several weeks now since David first asked us to find a mechanicality in ourselves and to observe it without attempting to change it in any way. When this request produced no responses, he asked us again, and we received several useful, even powerful, reports from the class, as I mentioned, Aria, Jim H., and Hawk Lady. My own initial response, Harry continues, a token response at the time, was my tendency to instantly and mindlessly react to certain kinds of phone messages, losing sight of listening to all of my incoming messages before responding to any one of them. I say token in that I did not feel there was any real exposure involved. It was merely one small annoying habit that was a promising prospect for observation. Anyway, that was the plan. Little did I realize that it would drop me into a true Conradian space where I would brush up against something far different than anything I'd ever before experienced. David spotted this immediately. When training as a therapist, Harry says, my teachers required us to first have ourselves cooked in the pot. Before subjecting some unsuspecting client to the joys of a hot seat. I subsequently learned many things about myself, most of which were not particularly pleasant. Since being adopted, I had unconsciously worried about abandonment and tried my best to cover this up. Despite having wonderful adoptive parents, I also would easily get angry when feeling powerless to affect events in a way that would, in a child's mind, better ensure that I wouldn't be sent back. All of this kind of stuff has a long shelf life.
I love that.
But let me tell you, and a can of it got opened up by prying into my annoying little habit. It turned out that underneath yet another layer of the onion, beneath the anger and overstriving, lurked a fear that I had not yet seen face to face. That underlined my chief feature of always appearing powerful and in control was my hidden chief weakness. The thing I least wanted to acknowledge, it was a featureless, empty space and bottomless. Whether a fear of dying or a fear of living, I don't know. There was nothing else I could say or do about it for the last month or so now, till it dawned upon me, after hearing the experiences of the rest of you. I'm going to read that again. Then it dawned upon me, Harry says, after hearing the experiences of the rest of you, that the act of staying in the space, now listen carefully. The act of staying in the space without reacting is the shock required to keep the octave moving. Whether my thinking center thinks that that may mean any given moment. Now I have an experience to flesh out the bones of what was just an idea. Now it has a taste. Somehow, just being there with the emptiness moved something, and something quieted down. I hesitated to share this since I have no idea if anything has changed or not in my behavior, which was not our assignment, or more importantly, where this might lead. My annoying little habit is still there, I suppose, although after another manner. When it is not there, it seems to have been replaced by something else, something more nourishing, but not more, much more pleasant. When I was thinking of moving in 1985, I think I first came connected with the school of E.J. Gold, and I started thinking about coming out to visit. I was living in Colorado at the time, and I was spending, I had a couple of my own little groups going. There was a group in Boulder, but also Lee Lozowick had a group operating out of Boulder. And I was often invited if Lee came to town, because the group members knew that I was quite interested in the work of E.J. Gold. And there was a close correspondence in the way these two individuals operated. So one night, Lozowick comes to town, and he has a thing. It was the middle of the night. I think it started at midnight or some darn thing, called the Tavern of Ruin, if I remember correctly. And the whole idea was you come there and you see what happens. So I went there, and I was, so I posed the question to Lee. I said, well, I'm thinking of moving to Grass Valley, California, and work more directly with E.J. Gold. And he said, okay. I said, but I have a question. He said, what's that? And I says, well, he kind of said he wants me to come out there and handle the business and finances and all of that of the organization. And I says, but I'm already doing that here. What's the difference? And he says, ah, but you'll be doing it there. And only after I got here did I realize what that meant. And then he said, the main thing, he said, and this is very close to what Harry is telling us here in his own experience, the main thing is just, this is Lee Lozowick saying, just hang out. Just persist in this. Just persist in the space to the extent you are able. And then persist longer. Because only in that persistence do you begin to see something. So when these elements hit us, the first thing to do that we want to do, the machine wants to react and go back to its normal haunts. And that we know exactly what happens. That's the road of sleep, and we will be there forever. But this group of individuals who's on tonight and who's here sharing this space with me this evening did something different. At some point, a little bit of a different path was taken. So we persisted. And so did each of you that is here. Each individual here is carrying all kinds of stuff around. It's not easy. It's not easy to persist and just keep coming back. But nevertheless, here you are. You're persisting in this space. And let's...
I think that is the hardest thing once you run across these ideas, is to persist searching and not even in the space, just persisting in following their path in that.
Just hanging, staying in the space.
Yeah, just staying in the space.
As Harry said, there's nothing else I could do, I could say or do about it for the last month or so until it dawned upon me, after hearing the experiences the rest of you have shared, that the act of staying in the space without reacting is the shock. required to keep the octave moving.
Mm-hmm.
Make sense?
Very important concept there.
So Harry,
yeah.
How you doing with all this?
I guess I'm still sitting on two stools, but not quite as much.
So you were adopted,
no,
huh?
No plan survives first contact with reality. So all of these ideas are wonderful to talk about, but when you actually do it, it was quite different.
And that's the thing that these individuals, you know, that you get, the whole idea of putting yourself out like that, like, is not so much that, remember last week we talked about the idea of what is a real question?
Mm-hmm.
That was in the last chapter. What's a real question? Part of the idea of a real question is we want to consider it in terms of mentation. And how does our brain work? Can we think of the right question? Here's a real clever question, you know, like how do oysters eat, for instance, might be your question. It's a tough question. But is it real?
I know how we eat oysters.
And so the real question is, has more to do with energetics than the form of the question. Make sense? So it's the energetic. So if you put yourself, Harry has put himself with what he's written in a particular position. Susan, you're going to interrupt me, right, if you need to?
Yes, I will.
Thank you. And Harry?
Yes.
So you're adopted, right?
That is correct.
At what age were you adopted?
Right out of the orphanage, about 10 days after I was born.
Okay. And were you raised with any siblings?
Yes, an adopted sister 3 years later.
How's your temperature right now?
Right this moment?
Yeah.
Oh, I'm it's an interesting state.
Yes.
I'm fine. I'm watching
right,
you last thing.
Right there, what's that?
What, my comment?
No. I mean, there's something went through. There's just something right behind that laughter, before the laughter hit. It was just something I felt. I don't know if it means anything.
Well, you have me at a loss, so that means you're probably
right.
Yeah.
You just want to build up underneath.
Susan, we can barely hear you, buddy.
Oh, I said David's looking for the feeling underneath the laughter.
Yeah.
Well, I'm not sure laughter at what particular thing that he has said.
Yeah, that's okay. Hey, Aria said she felt it as well, I believe. That's what I'm trying to get to, is that there are these flows of energetics that if we start to live our lives in a different manner than the manner called the historical personality, and we begin to sense this movement, then we can see something. At that moment, like you were starting to talk about your adoptive family, and then you had a sister 3 years later. At this point, you're a three-year-old, and you suddenly, now there's a sister. And it's very confusing to be adopted. It's enormously confusing because the child, and we can have compassion for this three-year-old child, Harry. All of us can.
Yeah.
And that three-year-old child has no way of knowing what it means even to be adopted.
Actually, I never did. I did not understand it when my parents would express it to me.
When did they tell me that they were glad
they got me in?
What was your age when you were actually told the words?
I don't remember. I remember Dr. Parsons had advised my parents to let me know about this at the earliest date, so I don't know how old I was. I cannot remember not knowing that. If that helps.
Got it. Okay. I was adopted. I was also adopted, but right out of the hospital as well. And
really?
When I was... My parents, I was adopted into, things were very different. This was in 1950, and the whole adoptive process was very, much more informal. It was still legal, there was still a legal part to it, but families would come together and they'd meet each other and they'd say, would you adopt my child? And my older sister had been adopted, and then all of this is hearsay, by the way. Because I was told this. How would I actually know, right? And then our parents, because we were adopted from the same parents, she got pregnant again. Our mother got pregnant with me, and said, would you adopt my child when it's born? It happened to be me. And this was born into a Mexican family, heavily Catholic. And so time went on. And about 5 years later, after I was born, my younger sister was also adopted. When I was seven, with all pomp and circumstance, my parents took us to church. We went to Catholic church, we had confession, received communion, and then we came home, and we're all dressed in our Sunday best, right? And I'll never forget the moment, because we had this beautiful plate glass window, big window looking at a big lawn that we had, well manicured, really wonderful. And we got home, right? So we're right in the mode of church, right? This space. And my parents said, they told us, you're adopted. I was seven, my sister was eight, and my other sister was four. I had no idea what the word meant. So I heard the word, it went in, and I'm just like kind of like dumbfounded, just staring back at my parents. It meant something, and it meant something weird. And that's when I was told, Harry.
So you were seven when they told you?
Yeah.
You had no idea what they were talking about?
I didn't know what the word meant. But interestingly enough, I didn't have any clue that this was an issue until that day.
Right. Well, I actually didn't think it was an issue until whenever I became an adult, because they were always telling me that they had chosen me, and that other people, the kids that made fun of me at school saying you're adopted, I didn't know what they were saying. That means we chose you. And their parents are stuck with what they got, but we chose you. So I kind of completed something on my own. I took this interject and decided, well, since they made this choice, I better really behave so they don't send me back.
Right. Mm-hmm. Really behave so they don't send me back.
Yeah.
There's the other half of the story, though, Harry, because I heard that one, too, you know, that, oh, how nice. We picked you. We selected you. But there's also the half that our birth parents gave us up.
That's correct.
We were given up by the very birth parents that brought us into the planet.
So you better hold on to the ones that you do have, was the conclusion I came to.
Well, that kind of happened to me. When I was young, about 7, my aunt took me to the beach, my aunt that came out from Massachusetts to California, where I was living, and she said, she sat me down on the beach in the sand, and she said, "What if I told you that your mother was not your mother and your father was not your father? What would you say to that?" What? What does that mean? So she wouldn't tell me who they, you know, who, anything more. It was pretty short conversation, basically. We got home, and my mother said, "Well, did your aunt talk to you?" And I said, "Yes." And she said, "Well, what did she say?" And she said, "Well, she said, my mother was not my mother and my father was not my father." And my mother said, "Well, what do you think about that?" And I said, I guess you guys are the only parents I've ever known, so I guess you're my parents. And my mother said, "Okay, well, I guess we'll have no more talk about that." And she never let my brothers know. See, my brothers were absent during all of this. So my brothers don't believe me. We've had a big falling out about this. They're 8 and 9 years older than I am. And I've had these memories come up, and they don't recognize it. So instead of getting blood tests and all that, you know, and destroying the whole family, I guess, you know, they're the only brothers I've ever known. So as far as I'm concerned, they're my brothers. But it was a very weird situation because my mother would not let me talk about it. She never let me bring up the subject as to, you know, who it was. And
it's just about as weird as the experience I'm having now, looking at you two on the screen, having been through the same experience I have.
That's right. That's right.
Pretty strange.
Try wrapping your mind around that.
Yeah, that is. That's bizarre.
So, what's going on here then?
Well, there's a comment from Mark Roach.
Thank you, yeah.
He said, that could also mean that someone cared enough about you to give you up, rather than put you through the suffering with a possible harsh existence.
So true, so true. Yeah. I've looked at that too. Yeah. You don't know what the birth parents were actually going through at that time. You know, I've met many birth parents who were in very traumatic situations during the time, and they, you know, it was better for the child.
And in 1943, it was very, very secretive and charged with emotion, I'm told, back then on adoption procedure. That was in the middle of World War II, so I have no idea. I have no information whatsoever about my biological.
Exactly. We're all baby boomers, apparently. You know, I'm 47.
Yeah.
So, it was, I think it was easy parents couldn't take care of their children, and times were different.
Yeah.
Well, Hawk Lady says, you can't comprehend when you're a child.
Yeah, you can't comprehend that when you are a child. I mean, it just all goes over your head.
No.
But it's settled, and here it is still on board, you know, many years later.
The word adopted probably needed a definition for us. We needed a dictionary for that one. We didn't know what that word meant.
You know, and I'd like to just throw in my two cents. We can all understand the trauma of being an adopted child and all that touches upon within us internally. But but everybody participating tonight has probably had similar but different traumas that have equally touched them. And this becomes a part of the associative processes of our mechanical historical personality. And we get trapped into a world, a mechanical world of thoughts and beliefs and expectations. And what we're trying to achieve here is to separate our presence, which is not affected by any of this, and allow our presence to grow and participate in other dimensions, which transcend this lower dense world, which is an ugly place to be sometimes.
Thank
well
you
said.
So much. Yeah.
Indeed.
Jim H. has a great comment. He says, and it's the child coming forth right now. And that's exactly
yes.
how I
There's something, and this I pose, there's something about doing what Harry is doing, in a sense, participating in what I call the act of confession, which in a space like this is what it is. It's a true act of confession that releases something and allows the individual to participate more fully in this higher space that we're talking about. It's like you let it go. It's part of you lets it go. If I recall, Aria, when she was talking about this experience she went to, she had to let something go to the next level of energetic a few weeks ago.
There's kind of a line, isn't there? Kind of a place that it goes into the historical personality or it transcends that and we allow it to let go and move to a higher office.
That's why I say when you confess in a space such as this, when you confess in a place such as this, what occurs is that, in a sense, you're saying to the universe, you're saying, I am not that.
Mm-hmm.
I am not this historical personality.
Yeah.
In fact, I am so not that I can speak clearly about it.
Mm-hmm.
That was my experience, David. It was a way of saying, this is not who I am, but it is how I got here.
Yes. It's part of the particular subset that you chose, in a sense, to get to work your way through to get to where you are today.
Exactly.
So, how are we doing here, everybody?
Well, Jim made
the
comment. Jim added to his comment. He said, letting go so that love can fill the void.
That's
talk, lady. Yes. So we understand that it's almost like you have to like open the space and free it so more of the essential self can come in. So we're living not from the historical personality, but the ground upon which we stand is a different ground altogether. And that's what we're talking about here. So prayer absolute is in the form of an objective 9-step octave, which includes the two intentional retardations introduced by the internal activities, which is to say, the radiations of the non-negative force
mm-hmm.
of an awakened biological machine. Okay? I mean, that's... So, as we wake up and we put in the effort to just stay in the space as Harry is doing this evening, to just stay in the space, something's possible. Then in the next paragraph, E.J. Gold says, step one is the physical, step two is the emotional, step three is the intellectual, and then step four is the real emotional, step five, the real intellectual. But where is the retardation between me and Fa of the third and fourth steps? And then this is very interesting and worth reading and noting in the context of part of what we're talking about here. The first instruction reads, in motion bowing my presence comes to thee. This is the first note. The second instruction is the note. The second note, Ray, right on page 128. The third instruction is the third note, me. The fourth line reads, with pity for thy suffering, thy presence becomes aware of thee. This then is that first retardation. Silverdale put it really well a few weeks ago, or maybe it was last week, when he said that the physical, the emotional, and the mental, when they come into harmony with one another through this action called the awakened machine, then automatically the essential self comes forth.
I'll reaffirm that tonight. Once we can bring our thinking, feeling, and moving into equilibrium, very difficult to do because these three are designed to be in tension with, in a mode of tension with one another, to allow their interaction. But if we can separate them and bring them into a harmonious equilibrium, our presence automatically opens and is available to us. And if we want to know how
automatically.
Yep. If we want to know how far we have to go to acquire personal presence, we should be looking at how difficult it is for us to bring these three different forces, our lower thinking, feeling, and moving centers, into equilibrium.
And I'm maintaining that part of this idea of sharing in this manner, or what I call confession, is a way of doing that process a bit. Mm-hmm. It is certainly activating for many of us the emotional center in the historical personality, and it's subduing it.
Or maybe simply pacifying it.
Pacifying it's better. It's pacifying, it's a better word. It's pacifying it. You know, there's the old joke that, you know, when people die and they come before God and they start confessing all their sins and these enormous sins that they've created, and I did this and this and this horrible thing and that horrible thing, and God's sitting there bored out of his skin because he's heard everything before, mm-hmm. right? He's sitting there, he's heard all these sins that you're talking about, and all he wants to know is, do you have one new joke? And of course, we don't at that point. Okay.
So Jim H. says, the space now has angelic presence. My sense of the space right now.
Yes.
I wanted to say instead of the word pacify that we use, pacify, I'd like to throw in the word recognition. Recognition, I believe, brings about the passivity. If you recognize what's going on, what's happening, you bring your focus of attention to it, then it becomes something that you can incorporate rather than something that's there as a bugaboo, you know, sort of.
Yeah, well, in this case, Harry just declared the situation.
Mm-hmm.
He didn't evaluate it or judge it or react to it. He just declared the facts of it. In doing that, there's this phenomena, but you have to do it. There's the phenomena of actually then you begin to separate them. And that process of separation is the essential self starting to become more the master than just a passive looker-oner.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what's occurring when you take such a step.
That was my hope, by the way.
Yeah, well.
I'm glad I did it.
Let's just pay attention for a second to what Jim H. has said. Susan, would you be kind enough to read that again, please?
Jim H.'s comments?
Yes.
The space now has angelic presence. My sense of the space right now. And then we have the group agreeing. Jim H. goes on and says, in form and formlessness, my presence becomes thee. And Hawk Lady said the space tastes good.
Yes, it does. There's a particular flavor to it, or a scent to it, that is different right now than before. That, I think, is what Jim H. is telling us to observe, that there's something different there. There's a different presence that is available to us. And when that's available to us, sometimes all we need to do, all we're supposed to do, is hang out in the space. There's nothing more than that. We're not studying the American Book of the Dead at the moment, but for me, that's the chambers have to do with allowing yourself to be in what's called the cleansing radiation. The cleansing radiation of those spaces, right? You know, when you're in the cleansing radiation,
mm-hmm.
all we can do as students is allow ourselves to be so cleansed.
I think that is the be-all and the end-all of it. I think that, you know, that's the not a student space, but that's the space that we need to learn to hang out in so we can get those cleansing radiations.
And we're able to do that together so that all of us being together and the individuals sharing in the way that the individuals have in the last few weeks, that provides a boost of energy, of an energetic that takes the space to another level. Can you do it on your own? Yes. Maybe. The best way to experiment with doing it on your own is using something like Prayer Absolute. The specific form of Prayer Absolute may or may not work for you, but something like that form of Prayer Absolute prepares you during the week, during the day, in case it winds up descending on you. I have experiences all week long that just blow my mind. Like, why is this occurring? You know, how did this get drawn in? Because I was ready for it. You know, I'm in a regular business meeting today, and it just turned absolutely different. And at one point, you know, she says, "Well," and then she says, "Well, what are you doing, you know, the rest of the day?" I says, "Well, I have this class I do on Wednesday nights." She says, "Well, what's it about?" So try to describe this class to somebody. I was not successful, in my opinion. I can hear you now. Go ahead, Susan.
Hello?
Yeah, go ahead.
Oh, so sorry, but let's see. So Mark Roach said, know the truth or confess it, and
yes.
it shall set thee free.
Yes.
I couldn't hear that. What was
is to know the truth and confess it, and it will set you free.
Hawk Lady says the burning process feels like dying.
It is dying. It is dying to an old way of life, and it is not necessarily pleasant. These are not pleasant things, and these battles don't get easier. They do not get easier. They get more difficult in many ways. There's more weight to carry.
And Mark Roach said, I die daily.
Yes. And then therefore am reborn daily. And it's important to be aware of both processes, both the process of dying to the old and being reborn to the new. Because you're being born renewed, and it's literally, you're a new thing at that point. It's a new you. Okay?
You can celebrate that.
Hawk Lady said, my breathing changes and becomes heavy.
Just stick with that. Stick with the sense of the radiation that is hitting you wherever it may hit you. Wherever that radiation is hitting you, allow it to hit you. That is the cleansing radiation of this angelic space, as Jim told us.
Well, and Jim goes on to say, to me, Hawk, trying to manage energy and stay in the space. And I agree. I think we're talking about staying in the space.
We can't manage the energy, but we can manage ourselves and allow ourselves to just stay in the space sometimes, Susan, as you've worked very hard to do many a time. Just stay in the space.
Manipulating it is a whole different thing.
We're not quite there, and not at all, but we allow something to occur. To the extent that we're able to allow it to occur, then something is possible to come into this space. That's the whole point. And each of us can work on that individually. You'll be surprised at the opportunities that come to you. If you work on something like this, I'm particularly thinking, I don't know if Pat whirls on, but thinking for some reason, she's coming through real strong at the moment, but Pat whirls, you know, if you work on this, something will come through that will be a little surprising. It's just there. And how about Vidir? Okay, good. Wide-eyed and bushy-tailed.
And Aria says, the space is still and intense. Good stuff.
Yeah.
Well, I would like to extend my heartfelt thanks to everyone for all the good vibes tonight.
Good.
It's important to me.
Well, thank you for being a part of it, Harry.
Absolutely. And making the effort that you did to bring us to a particular point where we could look at particular things and help several of us free one small iota more, one just inch more. You know.
Well, I hope that sharing it has helped others as well.
And I also think it brings us all closer together.
Yes, indeed.
Well, we have, I don't know why I'm stuck on this chapter. I think we made two paragraphs tonight. That's a new low for me, potentially. So we didn't quite make it out of chapter 12 yet. But maybe that's okay, because I think I have a lot more thinking to do about it. Sometimes that's how I view this, that I have a lot more work to do on this particular chapter. I can't quite let it go. There's too much here. Yet, so we're still a couple of weeks away from our next meal, but we'll come back to this next week again in chapter 12. And part of it is just to use that as a fulcrum. We're using the chapter as just merely a fulcrum to move our world to where we want to be in these particular spaces.
Pathworld said we need 2 more weeks on Chapter 12.
2 more? Well, then I might need your help specifically next week, Pathworld. You and I can talk about it later.
And Arya said she's in no rush. It's revealing a lot.
Good. Somebody in the peanut gallery here said it could be a 9-stage process.
Eight-stage Austin.
Well, yeah. Mm-hmm. So how do you close such a space? How do you close a space like this? One thing is that there's more energy here now than there was when you started. And honor that energy. Don't dissipate it by however it may so be, but sit with it for a while. Hold it. Is there anything else that needs to be said or done before we close this space here? Is everybody here okay?
Yes, I am fine for one.
Well, I think Hawk Lady wrapped it up and said something is cooking for our group.
Yes, indeed. And it's a fine meal that's been served, so let's properly digest it and we'll savor it until next week when we begin again on next Wednesday.
And start with a new metaphor.
That was a good metaphor. Invocational dinner, I think that's what we've had.
We certainly did have that. So, thank you all this evening, and we'll look forward to seeing you next Wednesday. Good night.
Thank you, everybody.
Thanks, David.